Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank. Focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The downturn in the housing market hurt lots of industries. Builders aren't building as many homes. Real estate agents aren't selling as many. People are losing their houses to foreclosure because they got bad mortgages. Some banks are seeing lower profits because of those foreclosures. And now, the hedge funds. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday, the 20th of June. At this hour, two major hedge funds are on the brink of collapse, victims of their own decision to tap into the subprime mortgage market. The hedge funds are managed by the investment bank Bear Stearns. They got involved in the subprime mess by buying up securities that were essentially a repackaging of all kinds of risky mortgages. Now that the housing market has gone south, investors and lenders are scrambling to get their money back. Marketplace's Amy Scott tells us it's not just the big banks that could find themselves in trouble.
The two hedge funds invested heavily in securities backed by subprime mortgages. As more borrowers have defaulted on those mortgages, the value of Bear Stearns' investments has plummeted. Janet Tavakoli heads consulting firm Tavakoli Structured Finance. She says what's worse, the funds used leverage to finance their investments. That means they borrowed a ton of money from banks.
Leverage can be very good when everything is rosy. But when you run into snags, leverage, of course, compounds your problems.
Now the banks want their money back. Merrill Lynch seized $800 million in mortgage-backed bonds from the hedge funds and held an auction today. Joseph Mason teaches finance at Drexel University. He says this isn't just a Wall Street problem. Your 401k or pension fund may be invested in similar mortgage-related securities.
Those hedge fund investment managers create investments that are bought by our pension funds and mutual funds. Charitable foundations are invested in these. It's a broad investor base, and it's not the rich versus the poor.
The trouble is, Mason says, it's hard to know who's at risk. Investment managers don't have to report their holdings, and unlike stocks, these securities aren't quoted on an open market, meaning it's hard to know exactly how much they're worth until they're sold, or in this case, auctioned off by Merrill Lynch. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So I went on MySpace earlier today to see what's happening with my peeps. I saw Molly and Marcy and Lauren listed as cool new people. Molly already has 51 friends, BTW. Rupert Murdoch was not on that list. Perhaps that's because Rupert Murdoch doesn't want to be cool. He wants to be a Yahoo. The News Corporation owner is reportedly in talks to swap the social networking site, which he bought back in 2005, for a 25% stake in Yahoo. The story was first reported by The Times of London, owned by Murdoch. Janet Babin has the 411 from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
The deal reported in The Times and on website TechCrunch says Murdoch's News Corp would trade MySpace for a 25 to 30% stake in Yahoo. The web portal's had a tough 18 months. Its stock has dropped almost 30%. And yesterday, Yahoo's CEO stepped down. But still, millions use Yahoo email and news services. Tim Beharin with Creative Strategies says it's one of the most powerful web-based properties on the planet.
They, in essence, could give Murdoch a very solid direct connection to tens of millions of customers that are online that Murdoch covets.
Strategically, the time might be right to unload MySpace. The site hasn't exactly been on fire lately. According to ComScore, MySpace attracted just 34% more unique hits over the past year, while Facebook, once coveted by Yahoo, logged 89% more. Murdoch bought MySpace in 2005 for $580 million. If the rumors of a swap are true, he'd end up making billions. The deal might not be as profitable for Yahoo, but blogger Om Malik with GigaOm.com says the company's so panicked it might actually accept the offer. If it does, the biggest gain for Yahoo might be an intangible, Murdoch himself.
With a guy like Murdoch, you know, hovering around the company, I mean, he can push and pull a lot of deals, and I think what that company needs is like a really solid kick in the pants.
Neither company would comment on the alleged swap. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Great news for people who can't get enough grainy videos of talking cats, rapping Irishmen, and fake lonely girls. Apple says its much-ballyhooed iPhone will play YouTube videos. 10,000 of them, in fact. Only 10,000? The student loan industry is generating a lot of F's for itself lately. Attorneys General and Congress are investigating quid pro quo deals between lenders and college financial aid officers. Today, the Senate Education Committee voted to reauthorize the Higher Education Act. And as part of that legislation, the government would cut billions of dollars in government subsidies to lenders. Senators want to use the savings to boost funding for Pell Grants. Guess who's not happy with that idea? Jeremy Hobson has a report card for what the proposed changes would mean for student loan lenders, large and small.
Senators think they can save $18 billion over 5 years by cutting lender subsidies. Their bill would reduce lender profits on new federal loans by just 0.5%. It would also cut the amount the government reimburses lenders on defaulted loans by about 1%. Doesn't seem like a lot, but it is, says Barmak Nasirian of the American Association of Collegiate Registrars and Admissions Officers.
When such meager cuts generate that kind of savings, you kind of begin to wrap your head around the obscene profitability of the loan business.
These savings would boost the money available for Pell Grants. Students currently get a maximum of about $4,000 a year. That would rise to $5,100 next year under the Senate plan. But for the companies that offer federally backed student loans, the changes would be a nightmare.
This is raiding a financial aid program that's very successful. It's helped 50 million Americans.
Kevin Bruns is executive director of the lenders group, America's Student Loan Providers.
The fact is, if you cut lender payments by 0.5, the hit will be passed on to the ultimate consumer, which is the students and the parents.
Today's Senate legislation is similar to a bill passed in a House committee last week and to a proposal submitted by President Bush earlier this year. With that kind of support, changes to the current loan system seem likely, whether lenders like it or not. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a drop in oil prices didn't do any favors for shares in energy companies. Details when we do the numbers. Executives from five of the world's largest private equity firms parked themselves in hot seats at the British Parliament today. It was the second hearing into how those companies are taxed on the enormous profits they make in corporate buyouts. Many in Britain and the United States are calling for those firms, including familiar names like Kohlberg Kravis Roberts, the Carlyle Group, and the Blackstone Group, to pay far more than they do now. Joining us to talk about today's doings in Parliament is Francesco Guerrera. He's the U.S. business editor at the Financial Times. Mr. Guerrera, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about what the fracas is here. What are people so upset about when it comes to the kind of taxation that is being placed on private equity deals?
The issue here, both in the UK, Europe, and in the US increasingly of late, is the fact that there's a perception out there that private equity executives, this new masters of the financial universe are not paying enough taxes. The issue is exacerbated by the fact that private equity groups have experienced an unprecedented boom in the past 2 years. And so some of these executives are among the richest people on the planet at the moment.
They are paying some tax, right?
They pay some tax. But it's true to say that they pay, especially on their income, both in the UK and in the US, they don't pay taxes like you and I. So they don't pay taxes at the highest level of income tax. They pay taxes, the technicalities vary, but effectively they pay taxes as if they were investment, capital gains.
What kinds of questions did we hear today from this committee in Parliament, and what was the tone of the debate?
Well, I think, I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with these debates in the UK Parliament. The UK Parliament is a pretty quaint place just in terms of architecture, and the people who sit there are some of the, if you like, the intellectual elites of the UK, and they love asking kind of clever, witty questions. So a lot of the tone was very sarcastic and witty, and they were asking effectively, why is it that you should be paying less taxes than, you know, your chauffeurs? Why you should be paying less taxes than your mate? You know, and you know, the point was clear. You know, the point is, why is it that you rich people should have tax advantages?
And what was the answer?
And the answer was, well, we create a lot of wealth, and and that's a point that private equity industry always makes. Our interests are totally aligned with the interests of our investors. We only make a lot of money if our investors make a lot of money.
What can this committee actually do? And what happens, really, if they decide to change tax rates?
You know, there's a long road between a committee hearing and a change in the tax code in the UK and in the US. Mm-hmm. But what this does, though, it throws the spotlight on private equity, raises the political temperature. And as we all know, I mean, in politics, things can snowball pretty quickly.
And how does the debate in the UK potentially affect US private equity?
Yeah, the U.S. private equity industry has been somewhat shielded from the furore that went on in Europe. Let's remember, this all started in Europe with trade unions in countries like Germany and France accusing the private equity firms of shedding jobs and cutting costs and making people unemployed. It then moved to the U.K. with this tax issue. Here in the U.S., a lot of the, for example, the union pension funds are invested in private equity, so they have somewhat a different attitude to private equity because they have a stake in their success, and they have, to be honest, they've actually reaped some great rewards from being invested in private equity, mm-hmm. which then have flown through to the pension funds and their pensioners. So it's a much more of a symbiotic relationship here. Having said that, last week, for the first time, we saw a very similar issue to the UK, one being raised by two very powerful senators, Max Baucus and Chuck Grassley of the Senate Finance Committee. And they are proposing closing a tax break that has been enjoyed by private equity groups as well. And again, it's a proposal, but it's already gaining a lot of publicity and a lot of noise on the Hill. And again, there is a chance that this may become law one day.
All right. Francesco Guerrera is the U.S. business editor for the Financial Times. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
In China today, the government announced a nationwide crackdown on enslavement. The move came after reports of widespread human trafficking and the use of forced labor in brickmaking facilities. Since the scandal broke last week, officials have visited 8,000 kilns and released some 600 laborers who toiled in intolerable conditions and were paid pittances, if at all. The freed workers are now returning home. Marketplace's Scott Tong tracked down two victims who shared their experiences with him.
2 months back, 38-year-old Pan Zhifeng did what millions of migrants do every day in China. He looked for work in the city, by the train station. It was 5 o'clock in the morning on March 8th in the western city of Xi'an.
3 guys pulled up in a minivan and offered me a job, $10 a day. I said no. Then, after a skirmish, they dragged me into the van.
Pan says the thugs sold him for $80 to a brick factory owner in Shanxi province. On his first day at work,
they beat me 8 times because I didn't know how to do the job. They would strike me with unfinished bricks. Once they hit me with a stick till it broke into 4 pieces.
Pan says repeated blows to the head have mentally impaired him, made it hard for him to focus. but still he speaks with intensity.
The foreman would say, "You motherfuckers, if you don't work, I'm going to break your legs."
And he limps, too. For days now, the Chinese media have reported similar tales of young and middle-aged men forced to work 12, sometimes 18-hour days under horrid conditions. Robin Monroe of the human rights group China Labor Bulletin says all the victims here are migrants, the hundreds of millions of workers who are central to what many consider China's industrial miracle.
It's one extreme, particularly egregious case of a wider phenomenon, and that is a massive drift towards increasing social inequity, absolute gap between rich and poor.
On June 5th, authorities barged into the factory where Pan Zhifeng works. They freed him and half a dozen other workers. So far, the government says nearly 600 workers have been released. The ongoing crackdown exposes what Robin Monroe calls the mafia-like relationship between local politicians in China and industry.
When we're seeing the sheer scale of this, thousands of workers in this condition, this is not possible without the knowledge of local officials. They were taking part of the profits, they were giving illegal approvals, and they were providing an umbrella of official protection.
He says that umbrella also includes local police. In Pan Zhifeng's village, about an hour outside Xi'an where he was abducted, we caught up to several members of his extended family. This uncle of his thinks the police in the brick-making neighborhoods of China are being paid to look the other way.
To fix all this, we have to start with the police and punish them. It starts at the top. Otherwise, if you just deal with the folks from the bottom up, you're addressing the symptoms and not the disease.
As for the brick kiln owners, Pan's uncle would prefer them beheaded. So far, government authorities have arrested 160 factory officials. While much of the attention is focused on slave workers who are young males, some as young as 8 years old, many victims are older, like 56-year-old corn farmer Wang Jianming. He was not kidnapped. He was duped.
One day, two women approached me and offered me a job. They said it was a farming job, not brickwork, and that the job provided food, housing, and clothing. They said they'd pay me $2.50 per day.
Wang took the bait, and it turns out $2 is what Wang got for 9 months of work at a brick kiln. Forced work.
You couldn't run away. They even followed you to the John. The whole place was surrounded by mountains. And even if you tried to run, they sent two or three motorbikes to chase you. Then they brought you back and made you pay.
Wang's bosses let him go last winter, traditionally the slower season for making bricks. He walked, and he says he begged for 40 days on the way home. Still, some consider Wang Jianming lucky. He got out. Hundreds of children in this part of China are still missing, perhaps abducted, perhaps working against their will. Again, Robin Monroe.
Because we just don't know how widespread this is. I mean, if you have a problem this massive and this serious and this heinous in one sector of industry in this particular part of China, what about all the other rural areas throughout the country which no one is watching?
This is the grandmother of a missing 18-year-old, Sun Bing.
October 2005 was the last time he called us. The last time we heard from him.
In Xi'an, Western China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, helping fill the belly and the tank.
Here I drive by my little bug, and it's sitting there running, and somebody smells the exhaust pipe. God, it does smell like French fries. You know, it's true. I mean, we need to promote that and show that it can be done.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks fell today as news of a sell-off in Treasury bonds spooked some investors. The Dow fell 146 points, 1.1%, to end the day at 13,489. The Nasdaq fell 26 points, about 1%, to 2,599. The S&P 500 fell 20 points, or 1.3%, to 1,512. The prospect of rising interest rates affected bank stocks today. Shares in Bank of America fell 1%. Citigroup was down 1.5%. J.P. Morgan's stock fell almost 3%. Home Depot's shares hammered up 4.5% after the company said it will buy back more than 1/4 of its shares. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 5.14%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board reports its index of leading economic indicators for May. In Washington, the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee discusses protecting consumers from caller ID spoofing. And break out the barbecue, bikini, and beach gear. It's the first day of summer. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. I'm Tess Viglund in for Kai Rizdahl. Any hope of creating a low-carbon economy has to include nuclear power. That's today's word from the World Energy Council, a group that represents electricity generators. The council said nuclear power wasn't the whole solution, but had to be a part of the mix. What to do about global warming and how to wean ourselves off of oil is on the minds of many presidential candidates. But commentator David Frum says so far their solutions fall short of the mark.
Recently, Barack Obama pledged that as president, he would invest in efficient and clean energy technologies. His rival, Hillary Clinton, says she backs a strategic energy fund financed by taxes on oil companies to invest in alternative energy. Republican Mitt Romney says we need to initiate our generation's equivalent of the Manhattan Project or moon landing to solve our energy problems. They're all echoing President Bush. At the start of the year, the president told a Delaware audience that he thinks it appropriate to spend taxpayers' money on new energy technologies. Does anybody remember that we'd been here before? In the 1970s, the Carter administration invested tens of billions of dollars to develop alternatives to imported oil. The results? The Synfuels Corporation, one of the most flagrant boondoggles in American economic history, a market-flunking exercise that made even the farm program look like sound public policy. Why would anyone want to go down that road again? Here's why. Because talking about Manhattan projects and moon landings is a way for presidential wannabes to sound bold and decisive, while in fact hiding and evading. There's only one way to bring oil alternatives to market: keep energy prices high, with tax increases if necessary. Under that price umbrella, entrepreneurs, firms, and consumers will develop their own next best solutions, cutting back on consumption, devising substitutes, and so on. Incremental steps rather than an atomic breakthrough. But no politician wants to tell voters that they have to pay more for fuel to achieve energy independence. Instead, they offer delusions that government investors can somehow do what trillions of dollars in private capital cannot: discover a cheap and abundant alternative to oil that will deliver cleaner fuel at lower prices. The reality will be wasted billions and higher taxes and nothing to show for it. I guess they think that's a small price to pay to avoid telling the truth.
David Frum is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. One increasingly popular solution to the energy problem is using vegetable oils to fuel cars. In fact, the first diesel engine was actually designed to run on peanut oil, until folks realized petroleum was cheaper. Today, a small but growing number of drivers are starting to convert their diesel cars to run on vegetable oil. Fueling your car with vegetable oil is different from using biodiesel, which is federally approved and regulated. So many states are cracking down on these gasoline refuseniks. From North Carolina Public Radio, Jessica Jones reports.
When Bob Teixeira wants to fill up his 1981 diesel Mercedes, he just loads up his cart at Costco.
Soybean oil is the cheapest. There it is, aisle 324. And I can already see that we're in business. See the green cartons there? There's my fuel.
Last fall, Teixeira converted his Mercedes to run on vegetable oil for $500. The price, compared to buying a new Prius, was a deal, even though Costco's soybean oil costs more than gas, he said. The melting ice caps in Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth pushed the lanky musician over the edge. He slapped a sticker on his car that reads, "Powered by 100% vegetable oil." But then the police saw it, too, at a routine traffic stop.
They asked if they could examine the fuel in my tank. Actually, they said the diesel in my tank. And my response was, well, you won't find any in there. And then it went sort of downhill from there.
Teixeira was breaking a number of obscure laws. First, he owed the state a $2,500 bond to run his car on vegetable oil. And he owed $1,000 for neglecting to pay monthly state road taxes normally levied on gasoline. Federal penalties were involved, too.
Had I known, I wouldn't have gone through with the conversion.
Most states don't know what to do with these so-called greasers. Some impose strict fines and confusing regulations. In Illinois, regulations were just relaxed. Lawmakers in North Carolina are thinking of doing the same.
This is just not a direction that we need to go in with our dependency on petroleum products. You know, golly.
Stan Bingham is a North Carolina state senator. He drives a converted Volkswagen Beetle powered by used cooking oil from the legislature's cafeteria. Bingham didn't even know that he could be liable for taxes. He's working on measures to eliminate penalties on greasers that he says, like him, are innovators.
I guess if you heard in 1904 that somebody's flying around an airplane, you say, oh, you know, bullshit. But then all of a sudden, here comes one over, you know, or here I drive by my little bug, and it's sitting there running, and somebody smells the exhaust pipe. God, it does smell like French fries. You know, it's true. I mean, we need to promote that and show that it can be done, not curb it.
But energy experts like Jerry Taylor with Washington's Cato Institute say the marketplace will be the final judge.
It's not as if we need to see some tie-dyed-looking Volkswagen bug driving vegetable oil to get somebody interested in spending some time and energy and trying to research this. And we got plenty of that. But the bottom line is that the economics don't look very good for it right now.
Bob Teixeira isn't deterred. He says the state is willing to reduce his penalties, and that means he's going to keep driving his converted Mercedes until they invent a plug-in hybrid. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Jessica Jones for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, French cabinet ministers will have to say au revoir to le BlackBerry. Mon Dieu! Sure, they're distracting and addictive, hence the name CrackBerry. But that's not why the cabinet has to put them away. No, it seems they pose a threat to France's national security. BlackBerry's servers are based in the U.S. and Britain, and the French are worried that emails sent from the PDAs could be intercepted while traveling through cyberspace. But wired French officials need not worry. Other devices are deemed ça va bien. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow spiraled down 146 points, 1.1%. The Nasdaq dropped 26 points, 1%. The S&P 500 fell 20 points. That's about 1.3%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Phil Richards, Joel Stein, and Tim Bomba are our engineers. Next time on this program, an aggressive hedge fund disarms its critics.
It's a little bit difficult to kind of knock something that has at its foundation a commitment to charity, even though in fact it's just as aggressive, just as predatory as any of its competitors.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.